PS.net podcast. My name is Jacob Fortier.
And I'm Krissa Hendricks.
What is that?
That's just trying to be radio voicey.
Radio voicey? Yeah. I don't think you need to be a radio voicey.
Was it too sex hotline? I tend to do that. Sometimes
when I don't know who I didn't know who you were for 5 seconds.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm Krissa Hendricks.
That's a little bit better.
All right.
You gotta make me believe that you're Krissa Hendricks.
No, and see, now I'm overacting.
You are overacting.
Okay, let's just move on.
You want me to redo the intro?
No, that's cute. Let's just leave it. It's fine. Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody. This is my extremely out-of-practice co-host and your extremely out-of-practice host, Jacob Fortan. Thank you for joining us today. We have a special episode, and as you may remember, this is supposed to be one of, I guess, our last episodes, but I don't want to mention this every single time because it will sound so depressing. I don't want anybody to get depressed while they do it because the subject matter is still cheery, would you say? Something great?
Depends on your perspective.
Oh my goodness. Well, with that in mind, I want to tell you that today's episode is actually going to be about marriage. Now, I know that that doesn't normally sound like your kind of standard atheist podcast subject, but I think if you really think about it, you'll realize that, yeah, there are definitely religious components, and I wanted to talk about the religious components in marriage because this is the one thing that has been on our mind. As I mentioned on one of the previous podcasts, Krissa and I are getting married.
Oh, so they already know.
Congratulations. Oh, wait, no, is this a proposal episode? Did you know?
I just didn't know. You have known, though, right? I didn't know that they knew. I didn't know everybody knew.
Well, then why do you think that there was a question a few days ago on the mailbag that was asking us whether they can come to the wedding or not?
Because it's on Facebook.
Oh, yeah, that's true. All right. Well, for the uninitiated through Facebook, which is probably a quarter of you that are on Facebook and probably have seen that if they tried. I did make an announcement.
Okay.
Yeah, outside of that little sphere. But I had to, because I was going to do a marriage episode. I knew I was going to do one because I wanted to share some of my insights, some of my thoughts, some of yours, actually, in this episode because, to some degree, without a religious institution to dictate marriage for us, in a way, where are we left?
Yeah, okay, so we should answer some of the questions that we've been asked from friends and family and fans. When's the wedding? We don't know. What are you going to do for a ceremony? Is it going to have religious components? No, and also we don't know. So we don't know. We know it's not going to have religious components probably at all, but we don't know what we're going to do. So basically, whatever question you have, the answer is we don't know yet, because we didn't really think about this.
It's really agnostic.
We're agnostic about our own wedding. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. And part of the reason why I wanted to do the marriage episode is because of some of the interesting things that I have noticed as soon as we entered that world. This is a very different world for us, and I think it is very different in today's society as well. The definition of marriage should change. If we tell ourselves that it doesn't need to, then we're not being really honest. But here's the thing about marriage and part of our research that we're going to be talking about throughout the show is that definitions of marriage have always been rather difficult to nail down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first discovery that I made when I really started trying to look at marriage. Because for the most part, I think that my experience resembles the majority of experiences of people who listen to the show. They may come from a household where their understanding of marriage is largely shaped by the religious institutions around them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or the relationship that their parents had, or the relationships around them. For example, when we first, when we got engaged, we're engaged now, so now that we're engaged, when we first got engaged, we played this game where, because most of our friends aren't married or engaged or in relationships that are leading in the near future towards marriage. Yeah, exactly. You know, like they're in committed relationships, but they're not really talking about this idea. It's not on the table. So I wore my engagement ring and we decided that we weren't going to tell anybody and see who noticed. And the interesting part is that everybody knew that this was happening within the week, within the month, like really soon. So you'd think they'd be looking for it and nobody noticed. You know, we were out, we were with friends who care about this thing and nobody noticed because they're not looking for it because it's not on their mind. So I think, you know, marriage is influenced by the institutions around you, the culture you grew up in, but I also think it's really strongly influenced by the other couples in your inner circle.
Well, that is true. I mean, in my circle of friends, it's a very small circle, and in the respect that I am getting engaged, at least within my circle, this is a new thing for the group. In a way, we become a bit of a, I don't want to say a trendsetter, but a trailblazer in this experience. Because as far as everyone is concerned with the whole idea of marriage, and I think that people would generally agree, that it's declining in popularity. With the exception of people who are trying to legally get married, i.e. people of the same gender, the rest of us are kind of very skeptical about marriage. And that is where the story of our soon-to-be marriage starts, because the truth of the matter was that Carissa had always maintained the position from the get-go of our relationship that marriage was not something that she was interested in. The institution, no thank you. And in a sense, I can't really blame her. From the perspective of a woman, marriage is not exactly ideal. While the man will live longer by being married, he's going to be healthier. He's going,
statistically
speaking, of course. But you're just like, if you want to live a few more years, then gentlemen, you need to get married. As just a, that's just the way it's going to be. You will live longer. You're going to be healthier. But there's a trade-off. Your wife is actually not going to be any of those things. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that statistically, women will actually live a little bit less long than they than if they were spinsters. And that they end up sacrificing a lot more than their partners, specifically because child-rearing normally falls to, you know, that their responsibility. So they normally have to sacrifice the most. It's less enticing. Now, that's something that may be shocking to most men who have often regarded marriage, in fact, in the complete opposite way. Like, oh, I'm going to be taken to the cleaners if I get divorced, and I'm going to have to pay alimony and all these things. This is the other reason why marriage, even still now, suffers. There's a bit of a decline in it. People are much more skeptical about it, and I don't blame them. But at the same time, I think that our experience, at least when we start entering this world and noticing that the people at this aforementioned dinner party that you mentioned that we went to, there was one couple that did notice but said nothing. They were a married couple, and they knew exactly what to look for. In any couple, the first thing that married couples do is they look for other married couples. It becomes a weird club.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. Now I've got a ring on my finger. You know, I'm looking around, not even just in person, but like on movies and in pop culture for other people with rings, trying to decide, you know, figure out, is that an engagement ring? Is that a wedding ring? What situation is this person in? And it's funny because, I mean, maybe other women do look for that kind of thing, and maybe I'm the exception to the rule because I've never really thought about marriage at all, and now that, you know, it's at the forefront of my mind, I'm noticing it. Maybe other women do notice that are not married. I don't know, I can't say. But for me, you know, as a little girl, I was never the kind of person that was planning a wedding. I have no idea what I wanted. And then when I became of the right age to start making decisions about my life and what I thought I wanted, what I thought I wanted was to not be married. You know, I've got nothing against long-term relationships, but I felt like there's no advantage to being legally married. Why would I want the government involved in this? Why would I want to have a big stupid party to celebrate my relationship? That sounds embarrassing and self-indulgent, and why would I do any of this? And so, you know, for me, not only was marriage not in my mind, it was one of those things where I had already opted out of. So it didn't even process that information because it wasn't important to me.
Well, I think if we're going to understand marriage itself, I want to take a little bit of a step back. Let's take a step back in history and let's just ask ourselves, well, what is the real history of marriage? The truth is no one can actually tell you what the real history of marriage is because depending on the culture, depending on the time, it may have been, something else. Like, here's an example. There is a theory that says that the reason why people marry is in order for men to ensure the proper lineage of their children. As though without this sort of form of contractual bondage, a man cannot be sure if he's raising his own children. Now, I contest to say that probably the chances that you're raising your own children, married or unmarried, might be relatively the same, considering the percentage of men that are cockled in even a society in which a significant portion of people having children are married. So I don't know if that's a proper explanation, although, you know, sometimes a thing comes up not because it works, but just because people think that it works, right? There's definitely a strong paternalistic tendencies in many societies, and I could see that we have like this need in these strongly paternal societies to control the breeding population, i.e. women, right? This intense fear or and need for control will often, you know, result in draconian rules where women are, say, property or don't have any really fundamental rights outside of what's, you know,
well,
what's
if
dictated.
If we take that even further back, in Elizabeth Gilbert's book that you made me read, Committed, she talks about how, you know, she's following the lineage of marriage back and back and back. And what she comes up with is this idea that marriage really started out with people. I mean, it didn't start out with the government, or it didn't start out with male patriarchy, or it didn't start out with religion. Marriage was the fact that people want to get together. Coupling is going to happen. Coupling is inevitable. And coupling was the first thing that ever happened. And coupling created marriage, because you'd have this couple of people who were strongly bonded together and trying to work as a little tribe. And when you have that, the problem is that, you know, you can't, when you have two people that are connected like that, the government can't interfere, or, you know, the patriarchy can't interfere with that relationship, or religion can't interfere with that relationship. A really strong couple is actually very dangerous to those kind of institutions.
It's subversive.
Yes, to those institutions.
That's right.
Because you can't control what's happening in a couple's bedroom at night. That's what she argues. She argues that, you know, and it makes sense, because, you know, in cults, the first thing they do is they say, leave your family. Because your family is going to be the people, and especially your spouse is going to be the kind of people that are going to say, hey, you're doing something crazy balls. It's way easier to stay logical, I believe, and to stay, you know, reasonable when you have some other partner keeping you in check. So I think that's really interesting that she comes up with that idea, that the first form of marriage was the couple, and it was this not formalized marriage situation. And then marriage came in so that the government had to say, or the religion had to say, or the patriarchy had to say, basically, or society, that this was happening, and they had to acknowledge it in some way that gave them some shred of control over it, so that it wasn't so scary anymore.
Well, but here's the flip side of it. I think that the need for people to form couples is real. But if you look at really the way that marriage arrangements have happened culturally, you'll notice that it's not for those reasons. People get married just because they need a spouse, they need to reproduce. Case closed. Where now it's society's role in placing you in these relationships. Arranged marriages being a common example, or in tribal societies, where you're using marriage as a way to create extended families and create much larger nation states, right? Like, how long have people been marrying to create peace? Well, let me tell you, in Europe, it's been till pretty fucking recently. Up to World War I, basically, when that collapsed.
Yes, but that's still something that's new about marriage, right? I mean, if we're really taking this back to its origins, we've got to talk about the fact that you don't need to be married to breed. You don't need to be married to couple. That's not necessary. So marriage is this institution that exists outside the couple to add and impose rules on the couple, so that coupling isn't this random Wild West scenario. It's this more controlled scenario that the government can monitor, that religion can, you know, create rules for and expectations for and control. Otherwise, you just have these couples running around doing whatever the fuck they want, and that's, again, subversive and dangerous to societies. I think using marriage as a way to, you know, secure land titles and move, you know, change that all that stuff is, that's
contractual.
That's contractual, yeah.
Well, it's new in the sense that if you look at, say, the way that we have it in Europe, marriage contract rules that date back to, you know, around the 10th century, and like as early as that, it, and probably even a little bit more, where people are just now having to make, you know, place their names on legal documents, try to transfer land, you know, like just the normal rigmarole of that we often find ourselves. And it's not that different, except for we have electricity and a couple more luxuries and those fucking people did not have. But at the same time, I think here's the flip side of it. We have this strong cultural imposition, I'll say, in marriage. And we all feel this imposition to some degree. We recognize the fact that if it's such an important part of society and culture, there's a reason for it. And marriage somehow taps into one of the fundamental aspects of being, like you said before, of coupling, right? Well, it taps right into that. I mean, imagine a society in which most of the time, even a couple that gets together, the state can decide over time what your legal status is. They need some degree of status. Some status must be determined. The government cannot stand people whose relationships are not stratified. Like, what is your relationship with that person? You live very closely with them, so you need to make sure that is a legal
arrangement
to some sort, because to so much of your life is really in a sense mandated by the culture around you, and our culture in today's, you know, today's culture is government, in a sense. Like, that's who mandates that part, because they're the fundamental entity that really shapes and crafts the way that you live your life.
Okay, so as two people, because I mean, we should talk about the idea that wasn't the only person that was averse to the idea of marriage. You were also kind of like, no thanks. No thanks, guys. No thanks, status quo. This is not for me, right? So we were both in that position. Or was it just me?
I'm a natural contrarian. I don't think I can help myself. Okay. I think if a person holds a populist view, my first reaction is no.
That's true.
No. That's just how I am. I mean, I can't help it.
That's true, and it's very frustrating.
Sorry.
That's okay. But I think what would be interesting is for us to talk about, like, how does a couple of people, because you think that that's a perfect situation where marriage wouldn't happen. I mean, we had a great environment where marriage could have comfortably never happened. So what's the story, Jake, of how...
are you getting married, sir?
This couple of marriage contrarians are now engaged. Now, how did we go from, that's an interesting story, how we went from like, no thanks, to now I got a ring on my finger.
Well, I think perhaps it's time to travel forward and now describe why am I embarking on this journey? And to some degree, I think Carissa will admit the fact that it has been largely driven by me. I have been the champion of this idea, okay? She has adopted it, but I was responsible for planting that, you know, for inception. I did it. I incepted her mind. Luckily, it wasn't like the tragic movie. This was good inception. Yeah, sometimes you can do good with inception. It doesn't have to be tragic. But nevertheless, I guess what had happened was that we had been traveling a lot. And one of the things that I realized, or maybe that I secretly feared, was the less than idyllic travel circumstance that people can often find themselves. That you take for granted. You are in a foreign country. They could do with you what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is that your relationship as non-married individual is not something that is respected by the rest of the world. And you know, for me, my fear of something happening to you because of some, again, like I said, some contrarian view of the thing without really having thought about it, just of saying I should be against it because people are for it, struck me as not only foolish and arrogant, but dangerous. So I resolved to really rethink the issue. And I think that I mentioned this actually as part of the inception of saying I am worried about this very case with your desire to go to all these strange and exotic places that could potentially end up being bad.
Yep.
But the institution itself becomes somewhat of a protective blanket. The truth is that governments really do support marriage. And, you know, they support the creation of families. In our socialist country, the government gives money to couples who have children. They're like, have children. Because they recognize the strength and the power of that institution. For them, really defending marriage, and I don't want to say the way the conservatives look at it. They're just, they want a respect of that institution because as far as they're concerned, they know one thing that, you know, that is universal about marriage, is that you will have a much more peaceful society when men are married than when they are single and unmarried. It's just how they are. Men become less violent. They calm down, they have families, they stop trying to kill each other. It's really quite amazing. They fundamentally change once that kind of, I don't want to say pressure because it'll sound bad, but evolutionary pressure maybe, it will change them as individuals, and you do need that. You cannot underestimate that need. And I felt to some degree that maybe my prejudice against marriage prevented me from seeing some of the other benefits that were really being offered. I mean, it wasn't just in terms of our own finances, where we look at it and say, well, you know, there's a couple of options that we can look at, especially for, you know, low-income couples who are getting married or are married. There are programs or there are breaks that you can get. People realize, okay, you're a poor couple. That doesn't mean you're going to stay that way. They realize that young couples who suddenly get married, they usually have the same kind of pattern. Start out poor, grow, and then eventually they become wealthy enough to be of some interest and use to their society. The people who basically support the structure, the middle class, mm-hmm. essentially. Who's without them, you have a kind of horrible oligarchy. But you don't want people. You don't want oligarchies. Oligarchies are bad.
So Jacob's turning over this idea in his head and starts, you know, slowly slipping me little
hints.
What
being very supportive, I'd say. Me basically suggesting that I don't really mind either way because I'm not going to make a decision on two people's behalf, right? Mm-hmm. I was open to the idea that perhaps that wasn't going to be where we were going to go. You know, if your strong objection to it was sustained, I wouldn't push it further because I felt that if I did, you would feel resentful of any part of the marriage that might be taxing or difficult on us.
But here's the thing, though. It wasn't, I think the reason why the exception was so effective was that it wasn't a strong objection to marriage. It was just a realization that what I thought marriage represented, or the research I had done, the minimal research I had done, demonstrated to me that marriage was not something that provided me any benefits. There was nothing in it that was interesting. It wasn't that I was fundamentally against it. It was that there was nothing about it that was interesting. So I wasn't interested. But, you know, when you slowly slip somebody like that, little ideas of like, well, here's why it is beneficial, you know, and the travel thing really got me. The idea that, you know, we can be in a foreign country, I can lose my passport, and you know, you going up to customs and saying, this is my girlfriend, or this is my wife, and the difference that could make could mean being trapped in a country or not. That's a big deal. But I think what's really interesting is that, you know, so as the story goes, Jacob eventually convinces me it's not a bad idea. I let him in on the fact
Jesus.
That
on the sly. Jacob tricked me on he proposed to me on the sly.
Yeah. That's sort of what happened.
Was not first of all, folks, I want to just reiterate the fact here that the way that most people sort of understand how proposals go, again, is where does this whole popping the question idea come from? I think that popping the question is the worst fucking idea in the world. It is surprising someone with a very
big life-changing decision.
A very big decision. And sure, when people are expecting it, that's all good. Where someone has secretly been hinting at it, and it's like, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, I'd really like it. Sure, some people like surprises. Unfortunately, Chris is not one of them.
I do not like surprises.
Hate fucking surprises. Don't surprise and every me. Single cliche thing that you could possibly imagine. Like, I'm going to ask her at a ball game or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, I'm going to, for those of my friends who actually listen to the show, I'm going to make a confession. Hey, you know that surprise birthday party y'all threw for me? Yeah, I knew for weeks. Okay, that's the reason I enjoyed it. Because I actually secretly knew. The surprise about that birthday party was that you guys were surprised that I was surprised. That was the surprise, okay? It was all for you. But I had a great time, and thanks. But also, I was not. It was
Besides,
not a surprise. It was all an act.
Yeah, don't try to do that. She's going to Sherlock Holmes your shit.
I will Sherlock Holmes the crazy out of you. I knew for weeks. For weeks.
Yeah. So. Try ordering a ring for this woman that's supposed to be a surprise. When I tell her, here's my concession of basically the popping the question thing, where I said that I would give her a length of time in which I would propose. Like a 2-week window. And this was basically the best I could do in terms of surprise.
You're a bad negotiator. That's probably why.
No, I don't think it's bad negotiation skills. Honestly, I tried to think of a variety of ideas of what would be ideal. Finding nothing. And then basically doing it the way that we always do things, which is just kind of walk slowly into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then illumination.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite literally what happened in a very inconspicuous and luckily nostalgia-inducing way. In a somewhat chilly Montreal day where we were alone in the old port, which is a very wonderful area with cobblestone streets, and there was a small area, a little lake.
And a bridge.
And a bridge. And yeah. On that bridge, having already drank a few apple ciders to try to, I don't want to say give me courage, but even though you get to a position where you know exactly what you're supposed to say, where everyone knows what's going to happen, you don't always find the proper words, because I'm always the kind of person that wonders, well, maybe I could have said it better, or it doesn't sound perfectly right. It isn't le mot juste, you know? I love when something is so brilliantly put that it is the essence of brevity and wit. And when I don't have that, definitely in a situation like that with nerves rattling your stomach, you're not going to have that. But I was lucky enough that when I finally got on one knee, which I maintained that tradition only to maintain some level of girliness in the experience, at that precise moment, unbeknownst to me, the lights around the pond had lit up.
Yes, because it was like right at that point of the night where it's like sun setting and all that, and it's this area, you know, the cobblestone area, and it has all these antique lights, you know, the what am I thinking?
Lanterns.
I don't know. And just as soon as you went down on one knee, all the lights went poof, and it was adorable. It was great. Great story. Awesome.
Always a little bit of luck helps. A
little bit of luck.
A little bit.
Now, here's the interesting part. So, you know, we get engaged, we play the game.
That's not interesting before?
That's interesting, but I think
I painted it nicely. And besides, here's what's great. In the future, if I ever have to say the story again, I'm just going to use this recording. Because I think it was perfect.
It's funny, because when people ask, like, how did he propose? I'm always like, just ask Jake how it went.
Just say, listen to episode 157.
I'm not a good storyteller, and I don't know.
It'll be an episode. It's easy to answer that question. Listen to episode 157. That's all you need to do, and then you'll know.
Okay. Well, the proposal is very interesting. But for me, I think what is also interesting... Is that better?
Yes, absolutely.
What
much
is
better.
Also interesting is that once we were engaged, it was different. It was different in a way I didn't expect. You know, I thought, you know, basically we got engaged because I got talked into it and I got excited about this extra security. And also I started getting a little bit excited about having a nice big party, and that sounded fun. And, you know, I get to have a party. I like
you get to be self-indulgent. Oh my God.
I get to be self-indulgent. That's
fun. Who would guess that Carissa Hendricks would like something that's self-indulgent?
Super fun. Okay. So it sounded like a great idea. And there's no reason why we don't think we're going to stay together for till the end of this life.
To the end of days.
So whatever. It sounded great. But what's interesting is that as soon as we were engaged and I had the ring on my finger, things felt different. The relationship felt more secure. And everything seemed a little bit calmer, you know? Since we got engaged, I have calmed down about the relationship in a lot of ways.
Well, you used to have tremendously horrible nightmares.
Yeah.
About me doing all kinds of horrible things.
I used to have to
compete with Dream Jake, who was just a jerk.
No.
Dream Jake was a jerk. He was constantly being a jerk. And you would wake up being like, you were such a jerk last night in my dreams. Unbelievable.
But I would never make you pay for it. I'm not one of those girls.
Oh, no. Luckily, no. I mean more in a friendly way, where I was competing with... But he was a jerk in subtle ways, though. That was the thing about it. Believably jerky. Which is why I think you woke up disappointed at my dream self. And I'm like, how am I going to fight this Dream Jake? But luckily, this mean Dream Jake seems to be mostly excised from your mind, as he's now Fiancé Jake.
Mm-hmm.
A much more
mm-hmm.
caring and devoted man.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that just the nature of the new role creates a kind of opportunity for you to reinvent yourself. And the truth of human nature is that you have to accept the fact that the life that you have at any moment is a kind of 30-year bubble, right? And at the end of that 30-year, you will be doing something different. And that you just have to adjust to that. And I think that, in a sense, why I even announced, why I was stopping Good Atheist in a way, too, is because Good Atheist finds itself on a weird edge where I get to that new bubble, where I have to redefine for myself what I'm going to do. I have to look towards this other new life that I want to create for myself as well. And what do I want this new life to be? I think Carissa will testify to the fact that I've had a hard time determining what that is, because so much of my identity has been crafted in what I do. I mean, even when I do it now, I'm like, fuck, this show is going to be good. I like this show. Why don't I keep doing this show forever? I'm like, I can't do it. I can't do it forever. I have to accept that there is a new role that I'm going to be taking. And in that new role, I'm not podcaster living on ramen noodles. I'm not that guy. It was a fun ride while it lasted. I really did like it. And I think I'm going to take all the things that I learned from it. It's not like suddenly I forget how to podcast, for God's sake. It's just that the subject matter of what I podcast about might be very different. Like, this show is kind of a reflection of that. I think the reason why I wanted to do the marriage episode so bad, why I forced you to read Elizabeth Gilbert's book, which it's not a horrible read. It's just a little bit long.
It was surprisingly good. You know, I'm not. I don't like chick flicks. I don't like girly novels, and it was a little hard to talk me into reading a book written by the woman who did Eat, Pray, Love.
But you never even read the book, and yet, despite that very fact, there is a strong prejudice against that book that I want you to recognize.
I totally recognize it. I recognize that I have a prejudice against this kind of storytelling.
And you know, I know exactly where the prejudice lies. Do you want me to tell the story of why you hate it so much?
Okay. I don't even know the story, so I'm a little worried what I'm agreeing to.
There is a woman who has a cafe that used to work at.
Oh, no, don't. Okay. Can I tell the story?
Then you must tell the story.
I want to give it justice. Okay.
Tell the story, and this is why I think you dislike the book. Okay. I think this is an interesting tangent and explains why you dislike Eat, Pray, Love. So we're going to be talking. This is a little book review, folks.
So when I first quit my job teaching, and I decided to become an entertainer, after about 4 months of trying to do entertainment full time, I lost my mind and decided to get some kind of job so at least I know what day of the week it was. Because, you know, my schedule.
It's a mess.
I was used to 9 to 5 or precisely, you know, after school, working to teach kids after school. And it was really hard to convert over to this totally on my own schedule.
It was difficult to not be wanking it all the time. Exactly. The first part, it's like, I can't stop masturbating.
I just can't. And so I went, you know, I didn't want something that was difficult or, you know, really anything. So I literally went out to my front door with 5 resumes in hand, walked down the street that was in front of my house and handed out those 5 resumes, did a couple of interviews, and then chose to work at this cafe. And I never worked at a cafe before. I had no experience, and I can't believe they hired me at all. And this was such an interesting experience. I worked there on and off for like 4 years, and it was great. The woman who ran it's name's Karen, and she doesn't run it anymore. It's in Inglewood in Calgary. It used to be called Serendipity, and now it's called, I think, Cloud Nine or Nine Cafe.
Why doesn't she run it
Cafe
anymore?
Well, that's the story. The story is that I believe what happened was that she got divorced, and then she used the money to buy this cafe, and she was awesome at it. She really was. Like, she ran a great business, and the cafe was
It wasn't
pumping.
Just a cafe. I
mean, it was a cafe and a furniture store, which is a weird combination, but it worked.
But yeah, it somehow worked, and she seemed to have customers in both, and I think the furniture sales used to help quite a bit, because you sell coffee, and for God's sakes, it's coffee.
Yeah.
What are the margins on that shit?
You don't make a lot. But and it was a great environment to work, and she was a great businesswoman, and she'd had other businesses in the past, and I quit to go try. Like, I quit there every year, once a year, just to go do some stuff. And then I'd walk in for coffee one day, and she'd be like, I needed staff. Can you come work back here? It was great. It was awesome. And, but, you know, I came in one day to get a coffee when I wasn't working there. And, you know, her and I got to talking, because I think we got pretty close. You know, I considered her another mom. And she was talking about how she was going to sell the store, and she was going to go travel, because she read Eat, Pray, Love. And she wanted you know, she had been going through another divorce. And I might be giving too much. I hope she doesn't listen to the show, because I feel terrible that I'm, like, telling her life story. But anyway, she decided to go gallivant around the world. And I don't know if she did or not. But as soon as that happened, I had this weird maternal feeling of, like, is that a good idea? Should this woman be, you know, I mean, she's confident and capable. That's not a problem. But, like, should we really be gallivanting all over the world on her own? Is that safe? So I went and did some research, and I found that there's this, like, small cult of people women who had read this book and then gone on these solo expeditions with no traveling experience. Now, you know, I'm not that great of a traveler, but I consider myself savvy enough to know what to do and what not to do. And it's never quite safe for women to travel if you know what to do. But on the back of reading this book, women were going out, traveling, doing these crazy things, getting robbed, getting killed, getting, you know, and instantly I'm freaking out, scared that this woman...
Foolish book... This very foolish book, because here's the thing.
Then I hated the book. Yeah. And also, I hated it intrinsically, because it's a girly, crappy book. And I hate when like girly.
But she's not a girly writer though. That's the hilarious thing about it. She used to write for GQ magazine.
Yeah. Now that I read this new piece and I did some snooping around on the internet and read some of her old stuff, it's true. She writes sort of in favor of men. Like she writes clearly for the male demographic.
She obviously loves men. I think probably a little bit too much.
Yeah, but she's still. Even her old writing, though, like Committed and some of her old writing, yes, okay, it was writing for men, but it still got a little bit of girliness to it, and I don't know if she owns up to it. Like, in the beginning of Committed, the intro is, like, her apologizing for Eat, Pray, Love almost. She's like, it's not the kind of book I'm used to writing, I don't want to write that book. So she kind of sounds like
she was forgiven. True. She was forgiven for having made, or having helped women make very foolish decisions, but hey, you can't. I mean, should she be held responsible for that? She discussed herself that the reason she wrote Eat, Pray, Love was just because she was trying to get over her own divorce. You know what she managed to do? She managed to get in touch with people, allow them to empathize with her situation, and to craft their new little life bubble that I was talking about. The problem is, and if you've ever read, if you read Committed, which suffers from the same problem, it suffers from an over-romanticizing of the world.
Everything.
Where you just realize when she's talking about romantically describing, oh, look at these Buddhist monks and what a serene life. And you're just like, this is a cult where they kidnap little boys, put them in a very sexually dysfunctional environment, and then force the villagers to essentially work for them as slaves. What the fuck is that about? Don't you romanticize that shit. I don't care if there's tons of beautiful little ceremonies, okay? If there was a nice little ceremony around raping babies, you still raping babies.
But you know what? I completely understand why she's like that, though. Like, when you travel, you have to do that. Because
you don't want to see the dark side.
Yeah, you can't help it. I mean, your brain is almost shocked into doing that because there seems so much that's kind of
suffering, poverty.
Yeah.
But they're happy people. That's the whole thing, you realize. Yeah, they're happy. But it's just that also the environments that they're in are the results of much poverty, suffering, and crime rates a lot higher. You know, you're kind of doing the Russian roulette with a lot of traveling, especially if you are prone to overly romanticize.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot of going back and editing old shows of The Good Atheist. And I remember episode 62, we talked about this woman who had been in Egypt, traveling around, trying to promote world peace, dressed in a wedding gown, hitchhiking around Turkey and the Middle East. And it did not take long for her to basically be found, raped and killed by the side of a road, a sad testament to the fact that though you can trust a lot of people, you don't push that fucking thing too far. That's all. Don't push it too far.
Yeah, you need to be careful. Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing is like I have to admit that I am totally biased, or was very biased against this Elizabeth Gilbert girl, but it was mostly because I cared so much about this woman who was going to go off on this world traveling mission by herself, and that was very scary for me because I wanted to protect her. But I'm sure that, you know, there's a few women who got into trouble, and there's probably a lot that were fine and had a wonderful experience and a life-changing thing, and that's, you know, I'm sure maybe side B makes
but
up
look,
for
the tragedy of the things that happened to them. You know, the book was just a catalyst in a series of events. Like, for instance, if someone reads her book going through a similar situation and romanticizing the kinds of adventures that she lives, is a person who has experienced very few adventures themselves, things that they can write about. I'm like, that's a tragedy right there. You're just anticipating someone doing something stupid because now they've never really thought about the situation. They've overly built it in their mind, romanticized it. And then when crunch time happens, they're ultimately disappointed. Now, bringing us back to marriage for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Where I feel like, to some degree, her book, Committed, as a follow-up to Eat, Pray, Love, talks about, in many respects, her fundamental problem with marriage from the perspective of someone who had jumped into it without much thought.
Yes, exactly.
And I don't think, you know, like, with our situation, and the part where, obviously, we're not empathizing with her, is the fact that this is not something we jumped into. You know, this is something that was, we had been talking long about it, and I guess that the pros really did outweigh the cons enough for us to decide not only are we going to go with it, but we should try to make it as much our own as possible. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I guess we have to really... I want to go back again and talk about marriage as an institution and the way that it exists in Western culture. I know there's not everybody who listens to the show is necessarily from that culture. I'm sorry if I'm not an expert in your culture. I'm learning, though. I'm starting from Babylonia and Mesopotamia and working my way down, folks. I figure it's probably going to take me about 15 years to be an expert in all civilizations, catching up to like modern day. So give me 15 years and I think I'll have a good understanding of it. It's going to take a little while.
But is this you plugging for a show that you're going to be doing in 15 years on all the cultures of the world?
Well, no. I think that, you know, after I finish writing the Bible Stories book, I would actually really like to write a book about, you know, from ancient civilizations to now. A really brief history, as brief as I can go, like moving from each character that has the word great after them. Because you'll always notice that someone who has the word great after them created a giant massive empire that didn't last very long and collapsed on itself, but it was an amazing achievement at the time. Cyrus the Great, Sargon of Akkad, sometimes called Sargon the Great, Alexander the Great. I could just keep naming these figures through history that come and go as quickly.
The Great Book of Greats.
The Great Book of Greats, exactly, right? Who's all great? Because I think you'll notice when you look through the greats, you're like, none of these people were great at all. They were awful people.
They just got good PR.
Well, first of all, if you're going to conquer the whole world, when you did it successfully, you made sure that everyone referred to you as the great. You don't conquer a known world and then say you're Jacob the Reasonable. Yeah? Probably not going to happen.
Especially because you're not Jacob the Reasonable. Not even a little
shut
bit
up. I think I'd be a reasonable ruler.
No.
I'm sure every horrible desperate probably thinks that of themselves. But yeah, I want to go back to essentially talking about what we think as traditional marriage defined by Western civilization. All right? Now, Western civilization itself, you know, is heavily influenced by Greek culture. We know this, right? You go to the U.S., what does Washington look like? It looks like Athens, for God's sakes. Clearly, we know where the inspiration came from. And, you know, there's a lot of subtle Greek traditions that we've kept in marriage. Because they had marriage. In fact, they even had homosexual marriage. But again, it was a very private, you know, person-to-person thing. The state wasn't really involved and it had no real care. But with the introduction of Christianity, the difference between the way that religion was treated before Christianity became the, let's say, the dominant religion of what would later become the Western civilization, before then, the early Christian fathers really, they didn't even like marriage. Okay, if you remember, the early Christian fathers were convinced that the earth was going to end like any fucking day now, right? Jesus had made a very specific promise that not one of his disciples would, you know, but die before he came back. At least one of them would still be alive to bring in this bombastic new fucking world that Jesus wanted to create. And obviously, they were really excited about that prospect. So they were telling people, don't bother getting married. Don't worry about it. But, you know, obviously people were still getting married. They didn't stop because, well, obviously they would have died out pretty quick, that cult. Thing about breeding is it's really hard to prevent people from doing it. Catholic Church isn't even really that great at it. Stopping anybody from fucking. It just happens. And normally, if you kind of put weird restrictions on it, guess what happens to it? It becomes pretty weird and sick. Luckily, at the beginning, of course, you know, you can't think of the early Christian sect as being a very powerful institution. It wasn't. It's just a collection of religious traditions that are kept by a group of apocryphal maniacs, okay? These are people that were anticipating the end times. They were living, as far as they were concerned, in a shitty time where the one world government was real, you know? Rome was the fucking power. It's gonna, any day now, they're gonna fall, and Jesus is gonna come back when they fall because they're the one world government. And that's how they viewed things. But, like I said before, fortunately, it's really hard to get a bunch of nutbags, you know, these nutbags to get people to stop fucking. So they didn't manage this. And for the most part, marriage really stayed a private I don't even want to say secular, because I don't think anybody really viewed that as being necessary at the time. Yeah. They just viewed it as a very private matter between individuals and between families, because for the most part, the old traditions of, you know, families making alliances with each other, that didn't really change much. I mean, in the old in early medieval Europe, it would be more like trade associations, say, with bourgeois classes. Or it might be, you know, different farms that work or that are working together through marriage. Very much, again, the same thing. Arrangements, tribal groups, personal affairs of individuals, their own business. But, you know, as time progresses, the church begins to want to have a little bit more control over the way that people are starting to get together. I think that, you know, essentially around the 13th century, they realized that Jesus wasn't coming back. And by then, there's a long priestly class that's made itself very necessary in society by creating these new rules, this new understanding of their religion, where they are now, as an official institution, the only way to get to Jesus, who's now a no-show. So somebody's got to fucking manage this no-show. They create an institution, and they do this through essentially the power of the Roman Empire, which has just become the fucking religion now. It's just crazy. It just happened in a short period of time. But wow, they used to go from being persecuted to Constantine saying, okay, fine, you're in, baby. I need something to reunite the Roman Empire and to try to declare myself as a conqueror. Another guy who gets, you know, the great kind of thing. Another one of those fucking guys. But now you have an institution that wants to, you know, essentially control individuals. It's the new government. Religion, government, now that's fucking intertwined. And what's the first thing that they want to do? Well, they want to control marriage. But it's still, I mean, it's always subtle. It's never immediate. You can't just walk in and say, we're taking over, right? An institution even like the Catholic Church, regardless of its power, cannot be everywhere, right? They are not in people's bedrooms, like you said before. They are scattered. They're around trying to moralize you. But they can't control anything. The reason why we start seeing them being involved has a lot to do with the way that marriage in its secular form was being managed, where individuals began to need witnesses to marriages, specifically because people would, you know, like, how are you supposed to trust this contract's going to last? You know, especially if there's no form, you know, there's no formal means to enforce this. So they include witnesses. This is an important part that starts to be included in marriage. And in a sense, like, the whole reason we have, say, in the West, where we have big parties for weddings, partially comes from witnesses being present. But for the rich, they wanted to be extravagant, so tons of witnesses, right? They're always got to outdo the fucking peasants. So let's bring 100 witnesses rather than just 2, like those broke asses. So we just start seeing that more and more and more. But then in 1563... When they were facing essentially the first of the reformations of the that would later become Protestantism, where basically people are saying, we don't like the papacy being involved in this. We have all these other demands. We don't like indulgences. They had a whole bunch of fucking complaints. But one of them was marriage. And the Council of Trent was essentially established to determine what were the official rules, much of which have remained true today. And one of these meetings, because this happened over many, many years, like there's, I think there was like something like 25 or 26 councils of Trent. Like, it just went on and on and on. And one of the council, they had to decide how marriage was going to basically be done. Like, here are the rules. Like, it has to be done through us. I think I'll read you the exact degree. It says, in the degrees of marriage, the excellence of the celibate state was reaffirmed. So the first thing that they did was say, celibacy is the better choice. This is the most pure thing, because that is essentially the view of the church in regards to sexuality. Their diseased, cultish mentality of sex is that it is bad, all right? And even when it's done in marriage, it's not as good as not having sex. That's a pretty fucking diseased way of viewing marriage, and these are the individuals that are starting to craft marriage as an institution.
Well, the way they put it is that, you know, the worst thing you can be is a prostitute. A little bit better than that is married. And then, you know, virgins are the best. Because there was a scale, wasn't there, where it was like, you get, you know, out of 100. Who was it that made that scale?
I have no idea.
some bishop or priest made this scale where he wanted to communicate it through numbers. So he said, you know, 0 is the purest you can be, and 100 is the worst. And 0 meant virginal, and a 95 was prostitute, and a 66 was married sex. So it was like, that's how gross it was. It was further towards prostitution than it was towards the purity of virginity.
The other thing they really had a problem with, too, was divorce. Where previously, before marriage really kind of got involved, divorces were, I wouldn't say, you know, super common, but they were not unheard of. Like, and there was even women that could divorce if they were saying, like, for instance, the husband's not producing children. Like, there were certain rights that they had, even, and expectations in the marriage itself. But under the Catholic Church's view of marriage, and remember, if you study the Bible the way that they study the Bible, go back and try to understand their view of relationships is shaped largely by the relationship of Adam and Eve. They view Eve as the bitch that ruined everything, okay? Which, and they are very specific in the Bible to explain that the reason why women are subservient to men is that, number one, women come from men in some weird twisted biology. and secondly, because they fucked us over by eating the apple and giving it to Adam, then they are to be forever subservient. Oops. That is their role now. And, you know, the pain of childbirth being the other thing that just sucks.
Yeah, if we're getting married so I can be subservient, I think you're going to be pretty disappointed. No.
Well, see, this is no it. Under that new arrangement, under the Catholic Church's definition of marriage, this is where we really see a reversal in terms of all the progress that marriage had made up to this point, where women did have property rights. Not anymore under the Catholic Church.
Always all fucking gone. Us chicks over. Always. Oh,
fucking you over. Are you kidding me? That's the nicest thing they ever did to women. They burned you alive. Hundreds of thousands of women. Like, the hatred for women in Christianity is apparent. I mean, I don't think it was altogether that hard to convince most of these, you know, popes or cardinals to stop fucking women the way that they view them.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not too healthy. And look at the role of women in the Bible. There's maybe two or three that are not prostitutes. That's it. The rest are all whores. Or if they're not whores, they basically they fuck us over. They fuck their own fathers. It's awful. Just awful. There's not a lot of women to admire in the Bible. And the only one that you would admire, say Deborah, is a judge. And what that means is she's basically part of this whole military campaign, kills people. Not a good person. Not good. Oh, you know who else I'd add on the greats? Catherine.
A woman
makes the greats, eh? Just a psychotic, trust me.
Crazy.
That would be a pretty cool book, The Greats. Yeah.
Great book,
a history
greats.
Of the greats. And just to really find out that they're really not that great.
No.
Let's knock these fuckers down.
Yeah, anybody who has Netflix should take some time to watch the Medieval Lives, that series on Netflix.
Oh, it's so awesome.
That's pretty good. You know, and I think the book would do kind of the same thing that Medieval Lives does, which is, you know, it shows that our perception of the way things were in medieval times has been very much tainted by Edwardian views and, you know, modern narrative. But the way it actually was is quite different than the way we imagine it in our minds. Like, the way a medieval fair looks and the way the stories are told about that time, not accurate at all. Not even close.
Well, it's true that, you know, we look at the medieval age and say, oh, this is an age of scientific repression or the repression of knowledge. And it's not, technically. It is in the sense that the church is essentially taking a very strong position against certain knowledge they consider heretical. That is true. But for the most part, there wasn't a lot of, you know, intellectual debate from anyone else, because as far as they were concerned, they had figured everything out. They were just now looking to try to understand perfection, and thus they would understand God. This is why they're obsessed about, you know, alchemy and all this other bullshit. Why the view of the universe is so centered in this Aristotle or Ptolemaic view where it's like spheres. They're like, perfect spheres. Everything's in spheres. This is how we understand the world, through perfection. And it turns out that that's not how the world is, but it was a very neat worldview. But it's during the Renaissance where people start challenging these views that you notice this repression and things start to get pretty fucking violent. And that's a scary expectation when you think about the price of trying to combat a very subtle form of ignorance. You're like, yeah, it gets violent. People don't like when you challenge really deeply held ideas. When you start saying that you want to look at evidence rather than look at revelation, that is a very frightening prospect, and it will make people behave violently, which is what brings us in a certain, sense to the Inquisitions and all these other aspects where you're squashing elements of rebellion, and much of it is intellectual rebellion. It's not... it's a combination thing. Intellectual rebellion and trying to make property gains. Trying to take other people's property. It's the fucking most disgusting thing, and it happens all the time. All the time, property being stolen. It's like the most recent example, World War II. That's you don't want to hear the horrible stories of people stealing property and being like, yeah, get out.
Oof.
Like we're World War II survivors of concentration camps trying to go back home. Families are living in those homes, and then they say, get the fuck out.
Wow.
Yeah, you survived all just to have everything taken away from you by people who were opportunists.
So our marriage episode really came down to some depressing...
Right, but
crap.
Here's the good news. With that in mind, let's take a look away from history for a moment, or probably for the good of the show, because the last segment I really want to talk about, and I think this is the most important, about the future of marriage. And this is the reason why I wanted to get married, is because I looked at it as an opportunity to craft for myself what marriage meant. I suffer from... similar romanticism that I criticized Gilbert of having, where I always believe that it's how you craft something that ultimately shapes the world. Like if you craft an amazing legend, people will believe the legend and they will craft the world according to that legend. And I know it sounds wishy-washy and I don't have maybe much proof that that's true. Maybe that's that whole... if I understand history, maybe I can't prove it. But I really honestly do think that you have to craft things forward, looking forward. That's what people want. It's like a prophecy. It's self-fulfilling. But you have to craft something that is attractive to people. And with our marriage, I had, there's no cookie cutter thing that will fit for me. What does being a husband mean to Jacob Forte? And I realized, well, if I don't know that, that's fine. I have to ask myself what it means and to get to the root of it. If I just do what's expected of me and I never really gave it any thought, I don't think that it's going to be satisfying. I think I'm going to find myself in the same rut that people who went into marriage without thinking about it fall into, where they don't like who they were or who they are now. Well, you were responsible for that, sir. What did you think you were going to be at the end of this whole thing? Did you have an idea? Did you craft a fucking legend for yourself? Or did you just sort of say, we're going to make it up as we go along? I don't like that other option. I want to craft things. And sure enough, you try to craft it and life plays you tricks. And it definitely changes the course and direction. But I think that as long as you keep it general enough and, in a sense, beautiful enough, then it maintains its value, and you just want to continue to pursue it. I felt that that's been the way that I've handled myself. Like I have an image that I craft of myself of who I want to be. This person is impossible, unattainable, but I still think it's a beautiful image, and I continue to work for that image, knowing that I'll never achieve it. Why wouldn't I do the same thing as I craft marriage, right? And I think that at that freeing moment where you realize that it is possible, like you can meet someone in your life where you can sit down and tell them, I want to negotiate the fundamental rules of even a marriage, and that person's just going to say, sure. Then all of a sudden you realize that this is an institution for you, because it doesn't exist inside any other framework other than what you've negotiated for yourself. That's always what it's been about. In other species as well. It's just you two. Negotiate what you want. You're going to figure it out. But here's my advice. Try to use the rules to your favor. Maybe it doesn't sound like a very enticing thing when you find yourself with someone you're like, I don't really want to marry that person. Well, maybe that's not the person you really want to marry. I don't want to say it, but you know what I mean? Like, there's that pressure to want to be fully committed is probably the best thing that could happen to you, because it prevents you from being in relationships of comfort. Relationships that don't go anywhere. your life needs to move forward, needs to have direction. Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked Carissa to marry me, because I felt that that was the best way to have that direction forward. Oh, isn't that a sweet thing?
Aww, see, I ended with a sweet layer. You're just a big girl.
I am a big girl. Yeah.
Aww.
I have a big giant vagina.
Big old girl. Well, but I also think that marriage is also an interesting opportunity to, like, to take that next step forward. Where, you know, since we... I hate saying fiancé. I hate saying engaged.
Such a crappy word.
Since we get engaged.
It's awful.
Engaged.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do think about my life differently. I think about what, it reframes what you want. And you're exactly right in saying that, like... You know, when I was in a position where I was like, I never plan on getting married, it was really easy to be in casual relationships, which is basically what a lot of my relationships were. Very casual, non-committal, like, committed, but, you know, I have my life, you have
your
life.
You mean loyal, but not committed.
Yeah, loyal, but, you know, I'm gonna do my own thing. I'm gonna, whatever.
Do your own thing, guy.
Yeah.
Guy incognito.
I don't care. But you're right. The being married or making the decision to get married does put a pressure on you to take a look at your relationship and say, hey, is this really a good partnership rather than just a relationship? Like, am I getting more of this than sex and nice dates and flowers every once in a while? Like, am I actually feeling, you know, fulfilled and driven and motivated by my relationship? And I think that's important. You know, like, it's a balance. You can't expect too much out of your relationship, because then your poor spouse is, you know, struggling to be your everything, and that's just fucking impossible. But I mean, you should expect more from your relationship than sex. You definitely should. Or than a casual acquaintance or a good friend. That's unreasonable.
Well, I think you just have to... You know, to the final word that I'll have on this whole aspect, because I mean, we could talk about it forever, but I don't want the show to last forever, is I would say that I guess for me the question of who I should marry was always down to who are you willing to make those sacrifices that you previously weren't willing to make, because to a large degree, relationships they have those elements. You cannot have everything you want in life. You cannot. But, you know, when you find yourself in a situation where so much of it is possible and where it does feel easy most of the time, let me tell you something. That's the best sign. That is the best sign, because everything else that you thought, you know, like when you're young and you are in love, then you think, oh, well, the feeling that I have, you know, that immediate rush, the butterflies and these things, you associate these things with love, when in fact they are actually infatuation. It's the strong, you know, it's to create a bond long enough for people to get pregnant and just be forced to now be together. It's evolution in tricking you. Real love is once that sort of fades and you find something else. It's like, it's hard to describe. It feels like a, I don't want to say a comfortable blanket of love, but you know,
it is. That's
it's
exactly
a comfortable blanket
is.
Of love that just sort of surrounds you, makes you feel safe and secure. And the anxiety that you used to feel about relationships, even if you never really recognize that anxiety as being real, evaporates.
Oh,
and
totally.
you feel like the rest of life can start to go on.
I don't know if other married couples can agree to this. I would love to have more married friends so I could have this conversation, but I never realized how distracted I was by relationships until we got engaged, and I just got way more comfortable. You know, I always kind of thought, like, hey, maybe the reason I never want to get married is because I really do want to focus on achieving my career goals and achieving what I wanted to be as a person. And, you know, I feel like relationships are very distracting, and so it was always easier to have casual relationships. But, you know, I never realized that, you know, what the most kind of distracting relationships, casual relationships, are the most distracting. They're so distracting. They require so much more work than a relationship that is truly committed and that has, you know, strong understanding and strong love and really good communication. That's, you know, everybody's like, oh, marriage is lots of work. And, you know, yes, okay, we're just engaged, and I'm sure we're in the lovey-dovey phase.
We're still on the line.
We got the fog, you know, whatever, that's fine. But I have never felt so relaxed and, like, not anxious.
No, the only thing that we find anxious is actually the idea of the wedding itself.
Ugh, I don't... Can we just not do one?
There's a strong chance that we won't, considering our fucking finances. I mean, the idea that a modern wedding costs roughly $30,000.
Yep.
Seems to me almost like it seems to me diseased, because the truth is, if you look at weddings the way that they work outside of this you know, of our little cultural bubble, weddings are actually used as a way to for people to build equity, a little bit of equity, as other villagers and friends give them money so that they can actually start a life rather than having to spend the equivalent of a down payment on a house to show everyone that you're going to be together forever. Let me tell you something. It's already not at a good start with your terrible spending. That's not
I
a good
do
start.
Think, though, I do think that I can pull off, because, I mean, keep in mind, I do a lot of event stuff, and I'm pretty sure I can pull off a pretty decent wedding.
I think it'd be a cool party.
For, like, $5,000.
I mean, don't underestimate. I think it'd be awesome, but we don't got $5,000.
No. So this is going to happen in a while.
Yeah.
Not for
But
a while.
The standard time for engagement is about 18 months. And yeah. But the thing is, whenever you talk to people, I guess because they're so curious about when the date is, I think it moves people to get married a lot quicker than...
I do feel the pressure. You know, as soon as people find out you're engaged, like, when's the wedding? When's the wedding? And am I invited? And it's like, well, I have no... I don't have any of those answers. I don't... We don't know when. We live on opposite sides of the country, so we don't know where. And I don't know if you're invited. I mean, one of the things I did a couple weeks ago was I sat down and I made a list of, like, the guest list, what the guest list would be. And it's just my portion of it. It's like 100 people, you know? And so I decided I was going to make a list of maybe 30 so that I would know what the list would be if we had a small wedding, and there isn't one. Because I can't imagine a 30-person list. I would feel so powerfully guilty for not inviting certain people that the only list I felt comfortable with was this insane 100-person list. Insane. But I don't know. I think so many people have contributed to my success as a person growing up that I don't want to not have those people around, or I want to elope and not have to worry about it, which would be nice.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we have some time to think about it, and maybe, who knows, maybe we'll do a special episode looking back and saying
we should have eloped.
Yeah, probably. Who knows if we're fucking broke from having tried to do a wedding and then discovering that even with the best of budgets, things just skyrocket out of control. Maybe everyone always finds themselves thinking, I can do it for $5,000, and then find themselves suddenly $20,000 in debt. It's a frightening prospect, but on a side note, this is why I feel like to some degree we haven't really figured the wedding thing out.
It's not figured out.
It's not figured out. I think that especially if we live in a world where there is a shrinking middle class, and then we are what I would call the rich poor, living somewhat below the sort of middle class, but not trying to live their lifestyle, not trying to get the mega house and the fucking nice car. We're just like, no, I'm going to have a nice little apartment. I'm going to keep things simple, and that's just how I'm going to be. Going to be rich poor, but I'm not going to be worried about my finances every day. If we live in that world, we can't still obey the same cultural rules, especially when it comes to marriage or any of these things. We need some other system. I don't know what that is yet. Don't ask me. If I had the solution, guess what? This show would be about the solution, and it would be, I don't know if it would be a boring show, a crazy show, but it would be about it, and it's not about it right now. It's only about confusion.
We're very confused.
Very confused.
I have a couple ideas. Although I will say that it was a really interesting experience trying to plan a wedding on $5,000, or
yeah. An imaginary number.
An imaginary wedding.
Not quite sure, but yeah. It was the lowest possible price.
Exactly. How can I? Assuming that, you know, you invited 50 people, 60 people, and I invite 100 people, how can I do a wedding for 150 people and feed these people for $5,000 and have a location and a reception and all the crap you're supposed to have, all this crap and...
Crappity crap crap.
So much crap. And it was interesting because simultaneously, for the first time in my life, I was doing this. I've never planned a wedding. I've never even thought I was getting married. This is a totally fresh experience. And on one hand, it is a bit fun. It's kind of fun and exciting. And on the other hand, it's super stressful, and I don't want to do it. And I hate it every second.
That's a common experience.
I do as well. I totally think that's what it is. I think that's why people hire wedding planners.
Yeah, that pretty much explains that part. But again, I think it's just because we're constrained by a particular view of weddings in our society, and we're influenced by cultural traditions that I don't quite understand, like the wedding ban, you know? Where does that come from? Well, it's an ancient Germanic tradition that essentially indicates that you have paid the bride price for your property. Yeah, we haven't stopped wearing rings despite that misogynistic background, have we?
Yeah, kind of don't want a ring now. That's sort of... ruined it.
Did it ruin it?
A little bit. Ruined it a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm.
When I read that, I decided that I was going to wait until the show to tell you, because I know that you take pride in that ring, but I'm like, if you really knew its background, you may not like it so much. It is an indication of your bondage.
I don't like that.
Well,
I like the word bondage.
Rephrase it then. Reappropriate it, because you know what? That's ultimately the trick that religions normally play. Like, if you look at wedding ceremonies for religions, I mean, there were weddings before their fucking ceremonies existed. They just, like any smart group, decided, hey, if you're gonna wed our way, right? Wed with our traditions rather than your secular non-existent ones. Well, gee, what are you gonna do? I got you a ring because I'm not imaginative. I thought about making a family crest, and you thought that was a terrible idea.
I didn't think it was a terrible idea.
Well, okay, you didn't think it was a great idea. I was trying to be creative here. That did not work.
I just thought exchanging pictures was going to be difficult to explain as a type of engagement.
All right, well, let's just conclude by saying that you can't just override traditions overnight.
Yes.
We'll conclude with that because I don't think there can be any conclusions. We're still very confused, but I thought at least if we did the show and still even explained our confusion, but our excitement and trepidation about such an event, it might be illuminating for certain individuals who will soon find themselves in a similar situation. I think a significant portion of our listenership,
and
quite
young,
and I'm like, one day though, folks, you'll be like me, getting married and stuff. Jeez.
Like grown up.
Like a grown up.
And everybody asks, you know, are you going to have any religious components? And I always thought that was really funny because, you know, almost like it, how can you get away with not having religious components? What are you going to do? Like, all these people are really curious. And I don't understand that at all because I think the difference is that I completely am comfortable and understand the difference between a cultural tradition and a religious ceremony. There are differences, and I'm very comfortable with incorporating cultural traditions, and I am not comfortable with having any kind of a religious ceremony. And because for me, those lines are very clear, this uncomfortableness that everybody else around me feels is not shared by me.
Yeah, well, you may discover, though, I mean, if we did try to go more the traditional route, that people don't really make that distinction easily. So you might find yourself kind of really wrestling with people. Like,
I don't know.
There may be an expectation.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, anyways, on that note,
I might eat those words.
You may eat those words,
and they're now eternal because they're recorded.
That is true.
Yeah, we'll listen to this episode after we get married. We'll be like, "This was terrible. We didn't know what the hell we were talking about."
This is great, though. I mean, if you have an engagement episode, you have as an accurate representation as you could possibly have before the onset of Alzheimer's.
Right. So this is the engagement episode. We'll do one before the wedding, and then we'll do one before the divorce.
It'll be an interesting show. It may be recorded in very separate rooms. Okay, well, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Krista Hendricks.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.